Welcome to Medicine Matters, the Springer Medicine Podcast. Osteoarthritis remains one of the most prevalent and debilitating joint disorders. Current treatments still primarily focus on alleviating symptoms such as pain and stiffness, but they fall short of addressing the underlying disease progression. This is potentially where DMODs could come in. DMODs, or disease-modifying osteoarthritis drugs in its long form, they are a class of agents that are aiming to inhibit or even reverse the structural deterioration of joint tissues. DMODs are an exciting prospect for our osteoarthritis patients, but sadly, despite multiple attempts, no DMOD is yet approved for clinical use. And so today, with the help of our expert guest, we're asking why these treatments are such a difficult proposition and what needs to be done to make these so-called utopia drugs a reality.
Hello, I'm Shreya Nanda, a Senior Clinical Content Manager at Springer Medicine, focusing on rheumatology and oncology. I'm delighted to be joined today by Professor Ali Mobasheri from Finland, and we're going to talk about the challenges associated with the clinical development of disease-modifying osteoarthritis drugs, or DMODs. Welcome to the show, Professor Mobasheri.
Thank you, Shreya, and I'm really delighted to participate in this podcast series and share my views and my thoughts with your listeners.
So to start us off, we'll go with the very basic of questions. What exactly are DMODs?
DMODs are basically your utopia drugs for osteoarthritis. They are the pharmacological agent that you really want to alter the course of disease progression. Basically, they are designed to alter the process of osteoarthritis progression, not just by impacting on pain and function of the joint, but also by altering the joint tissue structure, by reversing some of the degenerative changes. There are many kinds of examples in this class. So there can be small molecules, there can be biologicals, there could be antibodies, there could be cell therapy, gene therapy, anything you can imagine that could have an impact on the joint. And there are many examples that have been tried and tested. For example, growth factors, recombinant growth factors, monoclonal antibodies that target a particular growth factor and neutralize it, or cell-based therapies or gene therapies using adenoviral vectors, etc. So any of these things could be considered a DMOD. And in terms of its evolution, DMODs actually came from rheumatology, from disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, also known as DMARDs. So my colleagues in the osteoarthritis field felt that this would be an appropriate sort of transition and evolution from DMARD to DMOD. And so even though DMARDs are targeting much more inflammatory joint destruction in rheumatoid arthritis and in psoriatic arthritis, DMODs are supposed to target this slow-burning disease. Osteoarthritis is a slow-burning disease, rather like osteoporosis. It takes decades to develop. In some of us, it can progress faster, but in most of us, it progresses very slowly. So that's kind of the background to all of this. DMODs emerging, arising, evolving out of DMARDs.
Obviously, DMARDs have completely transformed the treatment of the more inflammatory arthritis. But then, and again, I mean, osteoarthritis is not a new disease. There are so many different ways that have, you know, been developed to treat it and manage it. So why is there a need for this type of agent?
Most recent estimates of the global burden of disease suggest that there are some 525 million people with osteoarthritis globally. So considering that we have about 8 billion people living on the planet, that's quite a substantial number of people with this debilitating condition. Actually, even that number is believed to be an underestimate because we really don't have accurate epidemiological data from sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and even South America. So there is an urgent need to treat osteoarthritis as this serious, slow-burning disease. And most of the current treatments only touch the symptoms and barely effectively. And there are no disease-modifying drugs currently approved for the treatment of osteoarthritis. And you know, the world is getting older, the population is changing, the demographics of aging and obesity, and these are having a massive impact on the number of people in old age with osteoarthritis, but also many younger people, many middle-aged and younger people with osteoarthritis because of the ongoing obesity epidemic across the world. Even diabetes and other metabolic diseases are also risk factors for the development of osteoarthritis. So DMOADs are not just symptom modifiers. They're supposed to be long-term influencers of pain and progression.
You describe DMOADs as the utopia, but they clearly haven't come into fruition yet. There are none approved. So what do you think has held them back? What are the main challenges?
Great question. So the main reasons are to do with the concept of osteoarthritis and how it's evolved. For decades, we considered it to be a wear and tear degenerative condition. But now we do regard it more as an active, low-grade inflammatory disease that has multiple subtypes. There are phenotypic subtypes and there are various molecular endotypes that drive the disease. And so the existence of these diverse phenotypes and these complex molecular subtypes makes it really difficult to develop a one-size-fits-all drug that can treat the whole population. So I'm afraid we have been incredibly naive to think we can develop a silver bullet and treat the whole population. That's not possible. Then, of course, we don't have the sensitive biomarkers that other areas of rheumatology and cardiovascular disease research have. The current biomarkers are relatively poor. The current clinical endpoints, the radiographic reliance on x-rays is also quite problematic because we know that x-rays take snapshots in time and they don't measure a dynamic process. And they're also not particularly related to intensity of pain. So there's a very poor correlation between radiographic change and the pain that the patients experience. And this is a problem because relying just on radiographs for clinical trial design and clinical trial, if you like, measurements is quite problematic because it's not sensitive enough. And then, of course, you've got regulatory hurdles. I mentioned earlier that the disease is slow burning. It's slowly progressing. And in many of the trials in other areas of rheumatology, of inflammatory rheumatic diseases, of cardiovascular complications of rheumatic disease, we're looking at very short duration studies of drugs that could be evaluated in a matter of months. Osteoarthritis takes much longer than that. So if you look at the guidance from the Food and Drug Administration of the US, I think you'll find that the most recent papers are suggesting timelines of between 2 to 3 years, but realistically 3 to 5 years. And that creates funding challenges. How many drug companies are willing to take such risks with single assets over that period of time? And the costs quickly mount up, not just to millions, but to billions. And if you actually calculate the cost of all the DMOAD drug development from, say, the late 80s, early 90s to now, we're talking several billion cumulative. And so these economic hurdles also need to be considered. But the disease is slow burning. It's heterogeneous. And we are really facing challenges in clinical trial design.
That's quite a lot of different aspects that need to be considered to even get one successful drug out, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And so what kind of research is being done to try and overcome one or more of these challenges?
Our own work and the work of our colleagues is focusing on understanding that disease heterogeneity. So we've come to accept that it's not a single disease, it's not homogeneous, it's highly heterogeneous, and it's really a broad spectrum of multiple subtypes. And so we are developing tools to understand those subtypes, what characterizes them. Can we take large cohort data sets and begin to break them down and subgroup them into these very unique subtypes? Of course, the older the cohorts get, the more overlap there will be between those subtypes. But there are lots of opportunities for looking at a disease in earlier time points, in an earlier, if you like, in a younger population. And so the solutions would be developing multi-omics profiling, like is happening in many other diseases, and stratification of those patients based on multi-omics and some of the biomarkers that are more promising. I mentioned earlier the biomarkers are pretty poor, but there are a few that tell us clearly what's happening in the joint. They're probably not sensitive enough for drug development, but in terms of studying progression, they can give us a rough idea of what's going on. And of course, one of the things we need to focus on is development of better pain assessment tools. Currently, we rely on questionnaires, and questionnaires can be highly subjective. You know, you could have a patient in a very good mood responding to a questionnaire, having one set of outcomes, and the patient who's suffering from pain and from the depression and anxiety associated with that pain, giving a whole set, different set of responses to that. And that's really rarely discussed from a psychological perspective. And so better pain assessment instruments are needed. And I think that in the future, we need to replace those highly subjective questionnaires with more agnostic and more objective assessments of pain and function, with tools and wearables that can actually tell the healthcare provider after a particular treatment, the patient is walking more and is more mobile. Even though they may be complaining about the pain, they are actually more active. And currently, the questionnaires are not really able to distinguish that. So you've got to do one set of questionnaires for pain and other sets of questionnaires for quality of life. And seldom do we consider physical activity and movement. And I think that's where we need to head towards measuring those and doing gait analysis as well.
Good to hear about all the ongoing research to address the key challenges. And hopefully we will see results soon. One other thing that came up in my research was the mode of delivery of drugs. So this idea that if a drug is taken orally, then perhaps it's not getting to where it's needed.
You've done your research very well. You've done the right reading. You're absolutely right. Look, there are constraints to the delivery of orally consumed drugs to the joint. You know, so the drug that's taken orally has to get across into the circulation from the gut. And then you've got to remember that the kidneys and the liver are actively working hard to eliminate that drug. So you've got those two systems working against the drug. And then you've got the issue of circulation and penetration. This is why a lot of us are thinking, well, actually, the best way to go is intra-articular injection. Of course, intra-articular injection is not suitable for all joints. You know, some people are trying it. Some of my colleagues are trying it for small joints of the hand and fingers. But really, intra-articular injection is best place for the knee because it's most accessible and best established for intra-articular delivery of the drugs into the knee. Patients also seem to prefer therapeutic that's injected into the affected joint. There's something psychologically, if you like, set up in the patient's brain that they are receiving the treatment directly where pain and the disability is. And I think we mustn't exclude this important psychological factor. And we need to really work with patients to deliver the kind of therapeutics that they prefer. And I know that this podcast is primarily aimed at scientists and the healthcare providers, but in the development, testing, and delivery of the drugs, we do need to consider patient preferences. So in a way, we've got to think about bringing the end user, the patient, into the development process at the very beginning of concept development. So what do you think about this new therapeutic? It's going to be oral. Tell us about the pros and the cons, or it's going to be an intra-articular injection. And so those are important points to consider. I want to read you a quote from one of my colleagues, Professor Francis Berenbaum from the Sorbonne University. "The needle is mightier than the pill." That's what he said in one of his recent emails to me. And that's what osteoarthritis patients consider to be superior. The needle is going to be working better than that oral drug, which could be circulated and diluted away from the affected area.
That's wonderful. And yeah, this podcast is very much aimed at healthcare professionals, but they need to be aware that the patient view is really important. So you making this very valid point is great. And then you know, in the day and age we're in, it's hard not to think about it. But what role, if any, do you see artificial intelligence playing in addressing some of these challenges that you've talked about?
So artificial intelligence is all around us, and it's having really significant impacts on healthcare and education. I think in terms of demote development, AI can have a really big impact by refining our strategy for patient stratification. Some of those biomarkers that I mentioned to you earlier, the imaging biomarkers, the biochemical markers, the experimental algorithms that combine them together could allow us to develop this AI framework where you feed into this data pipeline some really basic clinical information, followed by measurements of a key set of biomarkers, imaging, biochemical, gait, etc. And then the AI does this completely agnostic evaluation and gives you a risk prediction. Now, critics would argue that, look, long before the advent of AI for osteoporosis, we had FRAX, the very sensitive tool for detection of fractures, hip fractures, and the risk of developing those fractures from osteoporotic processes in bone. No, of course, we fully accept that, and we wish we had a FRAX-like tool for osteoarthritis, but we don't, because with FRAX, you have really reliable biomarkers that go into the measurement. For osteoarthritis, we have yet to develop those. But I think AI has enormous potential to help us test some new algorithms. And the way to achieve that is to generate as much data as possible and to deeply phenotype the patients and collect as much information as possible and then let the computers look for the patterns that we humans cannot see.
Looking to the future, how far do you think we really are from achieving success, where if we define success as a regulatory approval and, you know, routine clinical use of a DMOD?
Okay, great question. We have several very promising candidates in phase 3 clinical development, and the results of these clinical trials should be delivered by the end of the next 2 years. We'll be in a position to see whether some of these really well-developed trials are effective in osteoarthritis. So I would say I'm always a glass half full optimistic person. I'd like to think that within the next 5 years, we'll have some really good breakthroughs, and maybe within the next decade, we'll have some treatments. But some of my colleagues tap me on the shoulder and say, you have to be even more optimistic than that and consider the fact that some of these weight loss drugs that we are currently seeing in the marketplace, you know, being used in people with BMIs higher than 30, higher than 35, many of these individuals have knee pain and many of them have obesity-related osteoarthritis. So I'd like to think that some of the weight loss drugs could be positioned to treat obesity-related osteoarthritis and could be considered as a phenotype-specific DMOD, but it's not for everybody because you wouldn't want to give that treatment to a person who's got BMI 27, osteoarthritis in the knee, and, you know, healthy weights and no metabolic disease. So clearly, you can't give that particular drug to everybody in the population. And we need to continue to innovate and develop those DMOs and anti-inflammatory drugs that are also structure modifying for direct injection into the joint. But I think the future is bright. There are a lot of very interesting cell therapies and gene therapies that are currently being tested. And, you know, we had a very tough time with COVID, and COVID was a really important learning experience, and the regulators also learned from that. The scientists and healthcare providers learned from that. And the learning from COVID is that you can potentially gamble and take some rapid gene therapy advances, test them. And so I think some of the adenoviral vectors, some of the cell therapies could give us real results in the coming 2 to 3 years. And I think if we can collect all the images and all the biochemical markers and be able to, going back to AI, deliver this to the AI data pipelines, maybe we'll be able to get stratification. And who knows? for some of these agents, for some of these therapeutics, we might be able to see phenotype-specific, subgroup-specific responses. And I guess that's what we really want in precision medicine, to develop a therapeutic that very effectively treats a group. Now, the challenge in the economic aspects of pharmaceutical development is that they want this kind of blanket treatment. They want drugs that treats everybody. And I think even the drug companies are beginning to rethink their strategy and embrace the idea that maybe we do need to consider developing different drugs for different age groups, different drugs for different subtypes. And that process could be significantly enhanced by better biomarkers, better algorithms, and improved clinical trial design. And I think that's where the future lies. Develop smarter therapeutic agents, use the modern technology, and consider long-term impact on price as well, because many of those promising treatments that I mentioned to you that are currently in phase 3 clinical development are expensive.
Quite a lot to think about and plan for the future. And for my final question, and you've alluded to this a little bit already, but until we get a successful DMOAD, are there other recent advances that you are excited about that, you know, will improve the care of people with osteoarthritis?
Absolutely. We've learned the very important role of weight management and physical activity. We mustn't expect miracles from any biological or small molecule pharmaceutical agents. Ultimately, patients do need to be engaged with lifestyle change. And as I said to you earlier, a very large proportion of osteoarthritis patients have cardiovascular disease and they have obesity. And I think that's where you start. You start with lifestyle modification, with weight loss, bringing BMI back to healthy levels and being physically active, not sitting in front of the computer or the television all day, and integrating that physical activity into everyday life and everyday activities is really very important. And then beyond that, you know, then I think regenerative medicine, despite the fact that 20, 30 years ago, it was heralded as we're going to be able to rebuild body parts and replace broken tissues and organs. We haven't quite achieved that, but we have learned that many of the stem cells that we've been studying are quite potent anti-inflammatory agents. They are immunomodulatory agents, and they're not quite the regenerative cell therapies we were hoping for. But in order to rebuild something, you've got to take the damage and the debris away. In order to be able to regenerate an organ and a tissue, you have to remove the inflammatory components. So in the joint, as I mentioned earlier, the needle is mightier than the pill. When you actually inject the needle into the joint, there's some pressure differences. The patients instantly feel some relief. And in the process of delivery of a therapeutic, even if it's placebo, there's going to be some washout of some of the inflammatory agents and molecules within that joint. So we didn't have much time to talk about the placebo effect. Placebo effect in osteoarthritis is really strong. But that's one of the factors that could account for it. And the idea that the patient can sense the needle going in and the massive psychological power that that has on the brain of the recipient in terms of there's something beneficial. And of course, the way it's delivered is really important. The language that's used in the delivery and the preamble, the education, information provided to the recipient before that therapeutic is tested. But I think that's also another area for further research and development. We need to understand what's happening in the brain, because pain signals are processed in the brain. The signals come from the joint, but they go up via the spinal cord and the processing takes place in the brain. And dare I say, maybe some of the future therapeutics for osteoarthritis and other really painful conditions such as low back pain and, you know, other serious musculoskeletal conditions could be therapeutics that target the central nervous system. Let's not forget that the central nervous system is also a potential target, and it's not just the joint and the peripheral nerves. I think there's enormous potential for developing drugs that influence the CNS. And one of those natural ways to influence the function of the brain is reducing the chronic stress factors in everyday life. And also, that's why we see some many benefits from holistic approaches to osteoarthritis, mind-body exercises, yoga, tai chi. These therapies have a lot of benefits for people with osteoarthritis because they're also having an impact on brain and overall mental health. Sleep is also crucially important, and there are various ongoing trials to look at natural substances and herbal substances that could potentially aid sleep in people who have chronic low back pain and osteoarthritis. So there's a lot to do, but we have to consider the fact that those are adjunct treatments. They're not necessarily DMOADs, and the DMOADs are the drugs that we're going to be injecting into the joint, and everything else is part of that holistic, multimodal, multidisciplinary approaches we know are very important for the management of osteoarthritis, but they can't be defined as the DMOAD.
He's hoping, with everything you've said, that we will have the first successful DMOAD soon. And on that note, I will bring this fascinating discussion to a close, even though I reckon we could carry on for another hour easily. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today, Professor Mobasheri. It has been hugely informative and interesting.
Thank you. It was an honor to participate. Thank you.
This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals for their ongoing medical education and entertainment. It should not replace the professional advice of a doctor or pharmacist and may not be used as a basis for diagnosis or any change to the prescribed treatment of disease. The views expressed by our moderators and guests are their opinions and do not represent the position of any third parties. The information given in the podcast is subject to change as the scientific field and clinical advances progress.